Chapter 3. County Sheriff Trellin Ball received the call about the homicide of Ruey Ann Park shortly after he'd finished his Sunday dinner of a roast and potatoes and carrots. His wife Ruby had put the blue metal roaster in the oven before they left for Sunday school at the First Baptist Church. The Balls and their two daughters lived in Alma, a town even smaller than Van Buren, but both cities were in Crawford County. Alma was also the home of a religious group that had moved to the area, founded by Susan Alamo and her husband Tony. They built dormitory housing for their converts and a nice home for them to live in. Susan had grown up in a little community called Dyer, northeast of Alma, and had returned after becoming an evangelist with some followers out in California. Tony gathered up wayward souls to see the light and put them to work in a variety of businesses he started, such as home builders, restaurants, and even a clothing business that produced elaborate sequined costumes for performers to wear in Nashville and Hollywood. Many people thought the Alamos were a cult and wanted nothing to do with them. But because they were all registered voters in Crawford County, Trellin Ball courted them. He needed their votes for sheriff, and he got them. So did the mayor of Dyer, Fayette Peavy. On Sheriff Ball's drive to Van Buren, he recalled the many times he'd seen Mrs. Park. Before she and her husband Hugh divorced, they'd published the local newspaper, the Press Argus. Hugh had died of a heart attack some years back. As far as he knew, Mrs. Park lived alone. He ran into her in the courthouse now and then when she was looking up abstracts or marriage licenses or divorce decrees or tax liens. She imagined herself the town historian and genealogist, and she was forever publishing articles in historical journals around the state. What he remembered most was that she usually looked like she just woke up and forgot to comb her dyed red hair. But she never forgot the bright red lipstick or the rose rouge that circled her cheeks. Galoshes sometimes covered her feet, even on the sunniest of days. The Park home was a lovely red brick with two white pillars on either side of the front porch. It sat near the top of Logtown Hill, as the locals called that section of Arkansas Highway 59, also named Fayetteville Street. The area was once called Signal Hill because signals were sent from the stagecoaches on the famous Butterfield Trail to the livery stable in town, estimating their arrival time. Wagons delivering the mail traveled this way from Missouri to Memphis before being put out of business by the Pony Express, Indians, and marauding gangs of bushwhackers. At the bottom of the hill sat the main street of sleepy little Van Buren, where the Frisco train station had been turned into a tourist attraction. Across the street was the Cottage Cafe, the gathering place for old men to have breakfast and hash over politics, and where come Monday morning they would all be talking about the murder of Ruey Ann Park. Farther down Main and close to the Arkansas River, the Crawford County Courthouse sat, majestically surrounded by ancient oaks, complete with a fountain. It looked like pictures of genteel plantation homes in states deeper south than Arkansas. But the Park home on the top of Logtown Hill was not the picture of southern gentility when Sheriff Ball turned into the driveway. Several cars and trucks were already there, and yellow crime scene tape had been loosely strung around the back driveway. He parked behind the house in an area backed by thick woods. A brick sidewalk ran along the east side and joined a small porch supported by several rows of brick steps. He doubted anyone ever knocked on the front door, except for maybe a Mormon or a Jehovah's Witness. Wayne Hicks, the assistant police chief of Van Buren, a tall, fat man with several chins, greeted the sheriff, who could stand to lose some weight himself. Don Taylor, trim and muscled up, was an investigator with the Arkansas State Police. He wrote furiously in his notebook and didn't look up to acknowledge the sheriff. There was always a good bit of one-upmanship among the law enforcement agencies, and the sheriff quickly realized he was the last to arrive at the crime scene. He felt like a husband who is the last to know his wife is having an affair. "Well, fill me in," the sheriff said in his most official voice. "I got the call around 1:30 p.m., Hicks said.
The victim's son said he called his mother and she hadn't answered, so he went across the street to check on her. He took his keys with him because he knew her doors would be locked. She was real careful about locking the doors, he said.
Man, come on, man, what else?
He unlocked the kitchen door and found his mother dead in the den.
Chief Hicks lowered his voice and pointed toward the man wearing black-rimmed glasses, leaning against the side of the house, smoking a cigarette.
You know who he is, don't you? That queer lawyer, Sam Hugh Park?
I know him all right. I've been up to his house on some disturbance calls.
I think he done it, don't you? Him or one of his queer friends?
Sheriff Ball shook his head hard from side to side. Don't jump to conclusions, Hicks. Somebody might hear. The sheriff nodded toward Garrick Feldman, the new owner of the Press Argus, who'd written some unflattering columns about the sheriff's department's connection with a local religious cult.
I'm sorry, Sheriff, Hicks said. Nobody heard nothing I said. And you're right, you're absolutely right, I should watch what I say.
Sweat ran down Hicks's cheeks and pooled along his shirt collar. Wet half-moons spread under his arms, and he kept reaching for his handkerchief to mop his brow.
This is really something, he said. I'm so wired up, I feel like I might explode.
The sheriff hitched up his pants and tried to tuck in his white shirt. He still wore his Sunday shirt, and it was a little short and a little tight around his belly. He wished he had thought to change into his uniform.
Well, he said, I guess I better look at the murder scene.
Sheriff Ball and six other officers, including Investigator Taylor, entered the house through the kitchen door. To the right was a refrigerator, a Harvest Gold model, with blood smeared on the door. Across from the refrigerator sat the stove, and on the floor in front of it, a pair of women's house shoes. The hallway led to the rest of the house. Sheriff Ball let out an audible gasp. Mrs. Park lay on her stomach in the middle of the den, her left arm above her head. Her body was covered in blood, and under her head lay a large circle of what looked like red paint.
It looks like somebody beat the hell out of her, especially on the top of her head. You agree?
The sheriff said to Taylor, but he got no response. The sheriff asked another question.
Is that a Persian rug under her with a quilt over her?
Taylor still didn't comment. The sheriff pulled on the waist of his pants again. Ruby told him she could always tell when he was nervous because he hitched up his pants.
That looks like a pillowcase and a napkin by her feet.
How come? The sheriff realized Taylor was not listening to him, and he felt his face redden. He turned to Hicks and pointed to a long smear of blood.
Let's see where that trail leads us.
They followed it to the east door, past a floral wingback chair and five or six encyclopedia books strewn on the hardwood floor. Treading carefully into a hallway, they entered the east bedroom, which looked to be a guest room because it was so neat and devoid of any pictures or knick-knacks lying around. At the foot of the bed, which had no sheets or other covers, was another large circle of blood, and on the floor at the north side of the bed were other spots.
Whoever killed her drug her into the den, the sheriff said, scratching his head.
But why? Why not leave her on the bed? He looked around the room that contained two dressers and a baby's cradle. A mirror hung over one dresser, and two bedside tables sat on either side of the bed. He supposed they were all expensive antiques, but what did he know about such things? He shopped at Sears if he wanted something really nice. They walked through the rest of the house. The formal living room and dining room appeared to be used only for company. Pale green satin drapes hung at the windows, where a spectacular view opened up on an often photographed scene of the Arkansas River Bridge that connected Van Buren to Fort Smith. The master bedroom was at the back of the house, across the patio from the kitchen. On a bookshelf built into the wall was an unopened black purse, and next to it, three or four framed pictures of young boys.
Her purse wasn't taken, and the bed doesn't look like it's been slept in, the sheriff said. The covers have been turned down, though. Looks like she was fixing to go to bed.
A blue telephone, a lamp with a fancy white shade, and some books sat on a table next to the bed. Hicks picked up the phone receiver,
listened for the dial tone, and dropped it back in its cradle. He read aloud the titles of the books. Lovely Lady by Harold Robbins, The Thornbirds by Colleen McCullough, and Scruples by Judith Krantz. Never heard of them, he said. Of course, how would I know? I hate to read. He thumbed through the books, looking for notes or scraps of paper, and placed them back where they were. Boy, all these books around. Sure did read a lot. The sheriff remembered his days in grade school, reading the Hardy Boys mysteries. And when he got older, he had checked out all the Tarzan books at the little Alma library. I guess she was a real bookworm. They walked back to the den where Taylor stood with a camera in his hand, taking pictures. He had removed the bedspread, mattress pad, pillowcase, and a pillow from the body. Come on in, guys, he said to the sheriff. I think that cover was on the bed. The murderer pulled it all off together when he pulled the body into the den. I think that Persian rug was on the den floor, and it just got jumbled in along with everything else. The sheriff waited a minute before speaking, surprised but pleased that Taylor was including him again. That sounds about right, he said with authority. You think a man did it? Looks like her left hand is broken, with some dark hairs clutched between her right thumb and forefinger, Taylor said. She tried to defend herself against a man. I'm pretty sure a woman couldn't have done it. Well, Hicks said, she fought to the death trying to defend herself. Pretty good for an old woman.